Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, the important news of the week is the U.S. Federal Reserve, the central bank, raising interest rates. And Janet Yellen, the chair of the Fed's press conference, and the comments she made at that time and the impact that this is having on the U.S. economy and the global economy, and will continue to have going forward into 2017. Okay. This was predicted by me, of course, several times earlier this year. Just go back to the show in October. I forget the exact date, but you can listen to it on the PRN website where I predicted this rate increase was coming, and actually predicted even before that that it would be coming here this year, regardless of whether Trump was elected or not. And of course, his election and the euphoria it has stimulated in terms of business investors has accelerated or ensured that the Fed would raise interest rates here. And of course, they did this week, raised it 0.25%. Quarter of 1% from 0.5% on the federal funds rate, which is the basic benchmark rate, to 0.75%, the federal funds rate rising. Okay, now these are short-term rates, as I've said before, and the Fed can influence short-term rates by influencing this federal funds rate, which is just the rate that banks loan money to each other. But the federal funds rate is important because it's sort of a benchmark and it affects all the other rates, short and eventually long term. So if you raise the federal funds rate, it will have a knock-on effect here for other rates. And of course, we know if you raise interest rates, that's raising business costs and becomes just one more factor that discourages business investment, at least investment in real assets, as we say. In other words, making things, manufacturing, construction, so forth, building where real jobs are created here. So short-term rates have gone up, but long-term rates were going up well before that in anticipation that the U.S. economic elite are making a shift after 8 years of free money, pretty much, provided to bankers and investors, which boosted the stock markets, tripled the Dow Jones from 2009 lows to where it is today, about 20,000, and will continue to go higher because the animal spirits, as they say, have been released in anticipation, expectation of big profits, more profits coming for corporations and their investors. And that's what the stock market boom is all about. The Trump phenomenon here, they call it the Trump trade, is just an anticipation, not a reality, an anticipation by investors that they're going to make even more profits in 2017. How are they going to make those profits? Well, big tax cuts. You see, they're not going to really earn those profits. They're going to reduce their costs. Yes, their lending costs might go up 0.25%, but do you really think that this Republican Congress is only going to cut corporate investor taxes by 0.25% or something roughly the equivalent? No, we're going to see massive, massive tax cuts on corporations and the rich and their investors. You see, we've had 8 years of free money that has boomed the stock markets and bond markets and currency markets and derivative markets, and they've raked in the dough big time. And now they're going to rake it in again, but in a different way. You see, that's what the shift is. They've squeezed this free money, zero, near zero interest rates by the Fed for 8 years to their benefit of huge profits, speculative profits, financial asset market profits. And now they're going to shift to a new method of subsidizing their profits, and that's massive tax cuts. See, plus certain industries and companies will benefit from the talk about infrastructure spending that Trump is also proposing. We don't know how much. More importantly, we don't know what form that's going to take, you see. It could be, infrastructure spending by lowering taxes on investing in infrastructure, you see. So it might be all tax-driven, or mostly tax-driven, which I suspect it will be, and less on direct government subsidies and projects and so forth. And that will be the cover for justifying these massive tax cuts. How massive? Well, I'm talking about several trillions more. You know, Trump has proposed somewhere between $4.3 and $6.2 trillion in tax cuts. Now, massively, that's not the middle class. You know, that's corporations. That's the top. You know, I mean, just repealing or eliminating the provisions, certain provisions in the Obamacare ACA Act will give the wealthy 1% an immediate $33,000 tax cut immediately. If you're in the 1% range, you know, wealthiest 1% households, it will eliminate this surtax on the super wealthy, and that will save them on average $33,000 immediately just by repealing that, you see. And that's going to happen, of course. That's why businesses have been so opposed to ACA, and rich folks have been, you know, squealing and yelling about the ACA Act because they had to pay a little bit more than everybody else. They had to be subsidized to pay the government subsidy to lower income folks who could not afford to buy insurance. And now they, you know, under the ACA, they could, quote, afford to buy insurance. So the government was taking from the 1% and subsidizing the purchase of insurance, which means subsidizing the insurance companies. See, it was just taking, robbing from rich folks over here to pay the insurance companies. And in between, what did people get? Well, what they got was high deductible or low coverage, you know, emergency medical coverage. Anyway, I've been railing against that and other elements of this boondoggle called the ACA, which has some good elements to it, but the only solution to that is Medicare for All. And we'll see where we go with the ACA repeal. Anyway, to get back to the Fed rate hikes, the Federal Reserve short-term interest rate hike is giving more stimulus to long-term rates that are rising, U.S. long-term rates, bond rates, and so forth. We've had a rapid increase in the short-term rates, I mean long-term rates here, significant since Trump's election. The 10-year government bond and 30-year U.S. Treasury bond have escalated at a rapid rate here, and they will continue doing so, right? So this relationship between the interest rates and the value of the dollar is very strong. As interest rates rise, the value of the dollar rises. We'll talk about the impact of U.S. rate rise and dollar rise on the U.S. economy and the global economy, which is going to be significant. So to summarize to this point, once again, what we've got is rate increases and rising dollar increases as the Federal Reserve reverses its policy of the last decade of keeping interest rates at near zero, the effect of which has made money very cheap for people that are institutions that borrow. In other words, banks can borrow money were able to borrow money at 0.25%, and then they loaned it out to other investors and themselves, and those investors invest in the stock market because it's so cheap just to borrow the money and put money in and bet money on stocks and other financial securities, which has been happening, which I predicted, by the way, in my book, Systemic Fragility in a Global Economy, published in January of this year. And you can read some reviews of that book on my website. Go to my blog, jackrasmus.com, and you'll see the website, Jack Rasmus Productions, sometimes called Kiklos Productions. Click on that, and it'll take you to reviews on my website. Just click the Reviews tab. Anyway, to get back to the point that I've been predicting this is going to happen anyway for some time, what we've got is an apparent shift in major policy. You know, monetary policy, lower interest rates, you know, inject liquidity into the economy at great rates. Excuse me. Stimulate the financial markets, stock, bond, derivative markets, and so forth, enrich the rich, and hope that some of it trickles down. Not much trickles down, you see. Studies show that maybe one-fifth of the money injection by the Federal Reserve over the last 10 years has actually trickled into real investment that produces things and goods in the U.S. Most of it has gone into financial speculation, financial investment, stocks, bonds, et cetera, in the U.S. and abroad, globally. These investors are global now. Or, for a while, it went into stimulating real investment in emerging markets in China, but that's ended. Or it was hoarded on corporate investor balance sheets, which it still is. So those were the three effects of this monetary, central bank monetary-focused neoliberal policies here to enrich the rich quickly after 2008-09. And the hope was some of that would trickle down, but only about one-fifth trickled down into real investment. That's why we got such poor real economic growth here for most of the period since the crash of 2008-09. Now we're shifting to fiscal policy. Tax cuts and massive tax cuts, more. We've been cutting taxes massively ever since this whole thing began. I wrote an article here, The Real Sources of Deficits and Debt, and one of the things that pointed out was George Bush's $3.4 trillion tax cuts were extended by Obama, $300 billion in 2009, and another $450 billion as part of a $800 billion 2010 tax cut under Obama, and then Obama's fiscal cliff, another $5 trillion in tax cuts. Most of all this is investor business tax cuts over the next decade. And now, of course, we got Trump coming, and he's proposing another $4.3 to $6.2 trillion. So it's not as if we haven't been massively engaging in fiscal policy. We have, but it's been tax cut policy for investors and corporations, not spending, government spending policy. That's been austerity. All right, so now we're going to get a double barrel here. We're going to get even more corporate tax cuts, investor tax cuts, and fiscal stimulus and infrastructure spending. Right? Those tax cuts and government spending are going to rip a bigger hole in the U.S. deficit and debt. Right? That's coming. We're going to explode the deficit and debt even further. but it's going to enrich, you know, those companies that are going to make a lot of money from the infrastructure spending, which isn't the whole U.S. economy, by the way. It's just a sector of that economy. And the question is, what's going to be the net effect of rising interest rates and deficit, I mean, infrastructure spending? All right, we'll talk about that shortly. The net effects may not be as positive as people think. Right now, it's a lot of euphoria going on, you know, in the stock market and so forth. They all think this thing is going to be, you know, great for profits, and it will be for profits. But what's good for profits may not be good for the U.S. economy overall, and certainly not good for jobs and wages and income of the middle class, working class in this country. That remains to be seen. But right now, you know, investors are got the animal spirits going, as they say in economics, right? They're anticipating big paybacks here. The point is the paybacks are just taking another form, you see? Just another form. We had all this free money that was stimulating all the financial investment and capital gains and profits, right? And now it appears that free money may be turning off a little bit as the Fed raises rates. Okay, so that source of free money that ended up in all this financial capital gains, is going to be reduced. But to offset it, massive tax cuts and government spending. Instead of super low interest rates, in other words, saving corporate costs by reducing their cost of borrowing, now we're going to reduce their taxes even more, accelerate the tax deduction side of all this. So the net effect is the same. You know, it enriches investors and corporations and increases their capital gains, and you reduce taxes so that they can pass through more of this capital gains to their friends, their investors, their shareholders, right? Reduce dividends, reduce capital gains, taxes, and so forth. They get to keep more of it. And then we've got the infrastructure spending that will, induce some profit gains for certain sectors of the economy that are participants in infrastructure spending. So this is, they're just moving the money around. They're just shifting policies because the old monetary injection central bank policy was not producing. It was slowing down. It was causing, negative interest rates and causing instabilities, negative problems, and so forth. They figured they had squeezed that lemon as far as they could for 8 years, and now they're going to bring out another lemon and squeeze it, and that's the massive tax cuts and infrastructure spending. But the net result is the same. You know, huge capital gains for the investor class. So it's not so different, you see. And there's another benefit here that's not so obvious for the investor class in the U.S., and that is these rate increases by the Fed are causing and will continue to cause a massive flowback of money capital that had flowed out of the U.S. into emerging markets in the previous 8 years because of low interest rates. Right? Now that is causing havoc in rising rates in the U.S. is causing havoc in emerging markets, and the money's flowing back. So the Fed doesn't have to engage in liquidity injections and quantitative easing and so forth to provide U.S. investors with all this free money. The money's flowing back because of rising rates. You see, lowering rates provided all this liquidity. Raising rates now provides liquidity, but coming from a different direction. All the liquidity that the Fed generated that flowed offshore is now flowing back. So it's like liquidity QE deferred coming back. So to make a long story short here, investors are flux with money capital. You know, they're full of money capital coming from offshore and no longer being released directly by the Fed, but indirectly coming back from offshore and from major tax cuts and some infrastructure spending that's coming on the fiscal side as a result of the Trump election. Okay. It's the same policy by a different name. That's all it is. You know, the bottom line of the policy is how can you provide free money and cut costs to corporations and investors and cut and reduce their costs to corporations and investors. And the new mix is going to do the same thing by different means, that's all. The bottom line is the same, you know, and that's what neoliberalism and capitalism are all about. How do you keep the largesse flowing to investors and corporations? You know, what shifts in policies are necessary to make sure the flow continues? It's the flow that's important. It's not the means necessarily. You know, one means may work at one time, monetary means. Fiscal means may work at another time. And they've just realized, U.S. capitalists, that, you know, they've squeezed the monetary free money all from the Fed as much as they can, and it was causing instabilities. Now they got to shift that, and that shift is the new policies coming. Neoliberalism 2.0 is what I call this. You know, it's just neoliberalism by another means. And all of neoliberalism is about how you can subsidize investors and corporations at the expense of everyone else in society. That's what it's all about. Okay, so what are the consequences, though, for the U.S. economy and the global economy of some of this? Right. Well, the Fed, Janet Yellen, when she announced the quarter further increase, you know, indicated that, this is just the first. You know, we had 0.25% last December, and she predicted that there would be several more Fed short-term rate increases over 2016. They didn't come. Why didn't they come? Because it looked like China was in trouble at the beginning of last year. And then we had the Brexit vote in Europe, which sort of shocked that whole sector of the global economy. Right? And then we had the elections. And, of course, we recently had the Italian referendum vote rejection and right-wing parties growing stronger in Europe. And all that kind of stabilized things. And the Fed did not want to, throughout 2016 and election year, really do the rate hikes that are coming now, not only because the economy was a little bit unstable, but because the Fed did not want to appear politically favoring, you know, one candidate or the other. Raising rates would have wrecked the Obama economy earlier, and they didn't want to do that since they were pro-Obama, of course. And now, of course, you know, they are raising the rates after the election. So 2016 was kind of like a hiatus with policy moving sideways, nothing really changing. But now it's blown wide open. And rising rates, you know, Yellen predicts three rate increases over 2017. This time they're coming, you see. This time they're coming. The federal funds rate is expected to be at 1.4% here by the end of next year. That's three rate increases of 0.25% each. And then in 2018, another three, as they predict the federal funds rate will rise to 2.1. And then in 2009, another three, as 2019 rather, as the federal funds rate rises to 2.9. So we're going to get three increases in each of the next 3 years. That's the forecast, of course. It may not turn out that, because I believe the economy is going to tank before that. I think we're going to get a 6 months of euphoria here, and then everyone's going to realize that what this is really about is mostly more tax cuts and not that much real investment in the U.S. economy. Token. But that will take some time. Previously during this year, I had forecast that the U.S. economy was going to slip into a recession in 2017 because of the direction of where things were going and the growing instabilities from super low interest rates and the slowing global economy and the financial instability in China emerging markets. but I'm going to change that forecast. Obviously, we're going to get some stimulus here in the first half in particular of this year, and the animal spirits will keep the economy afloat, but the recession will come in 2018. That's what I predict here now, because of the Trump effect is going to delay it. But it probably will make it worse when it comes as a result. Okay, so Janet Yellen says she's going to raise raised three times in 2017. Now, those are short-term rates. Long-term rates are continuing to rise even faster. And long-term rates are far more important than short-term rates. There's a relationship between short and long-term. Short-term will eventually boost long-term a little bit, and long-term rates will force short-term rates to rise. And that's part of what's behind the Yellen move here, because long-term rates were rising already. Well, why were they rising? Because the U.S. dollar was rising. And it's this combination of interest rate and dollar escalation that is going to have a big effect, because it's going to continue, not only on the U.S. economy, but on the global economy as well. So let's look at that, some of the possibilities of that. Well, for the U.S. economy, you know, you can get misled here by all this hype going on in the stocks. And we got a bubble in stocks. You know, listen to the show last week. And basically, why do we have a bubble in stocks? Well, for a number of reasons, as I outlined last week. And one is the busting of the bond bubble that had occurred, that had grown. It's unwinding. Bonds are unwinding. Money is flowing rapidly out of bonds and into stocks. And also another phenomenon of small and medium investors are moving their money in huge quantities from what's called active investing to passive investing. In other words, putting their money in index funds and exchange-traded funds and just letting those funds follow the market. Now, what's going to happen with the U.S. economy here is, if you look at the real economy, it's not all that great. U.S. economy, and I don't care what Janet Yellen says, she keeps referring to, oh, we only have 4.8% unemployment. Well, that's the phony U3 unemployment rate. And most economists, you know, laugh at that rate. That's not, you know, the rate, unemployment rate in this country. This economy, it's much higher, much higher. It's between 9 and 10% at least, you know, when you count the people who dropped out of the labor force, when you count people who have gone on disability because unemployment insurance doesn't pay enough, when you count people who aren't being counted in the inner city, you know, in the underground economy, the hidden unemployed, when you count people who are working only part-time temp in these service jobs with low pay, no benefits, right? The missing labor force, all these other elements, the unemployment rate is not 4.8%. That's a joke. Anyway, but that's you know, what they refer to. Because if the unemployment were so damn low, why is there no wage increases going on? You see, full employment should mean tight labor markets and therefore wages being bid up. But they're not. Except for the top 10%. If you work in tech, you know, if you're a data scientist or a software engineer or something, you're getting increases. But for the rest of the people, there's no wage increases going on. So that proves that, you know, all this talk about 4.8 is phony. It's not true. You know, this is a part of economics that is more ideology than economic science. So we don't have that strong an economy. And if you look at it, productivity is pretty much flat or declining in the U.S. Real investment by business, in other words, investing in things that create jobs, right, is stagnant. Now, Trump hopes that the infrastructure spending will give that a boost. But if you don't get real investment across the board, and productivity increases, what you've got is, you know, productivity is declining. You have rising unit labor costs for a business. And what do businesses do when productivity declines? They take it out on wages. The only other element. You see, unit labor costs are a consequence of productivity and wage rates. So if productivity is falling, right, profitability is falling, therefore businesses take it out on wages. Maybe that's why we don't see wage gains. Because productivity is so poor. Well, productivity is so poor because businesses, as I point out in my book, Systemic Fragility, you know, make far more profits from financial speculation than they do from investing in real things. And that's been going on, that trend, for some time. And we see the results of it, right, in falling productivity and investment, in rising unit labor costs and stagnant wages. Okay. Not only are wages stagnant, and investment pretty much, you know, going nowhere, and productivity falling in the U.S., but if you look at key sectors of the economy, they're not doing so well. Housing starts, new data just came out, dropped 19% this past month. That's in anticipation of the continued rising rates. You know, over the summer, mortgage rates, 30-year fixed, if you had good credit, you know, was close to 3%. Well, now it's over 4%. It's risen over a percent, and will go higher here. So, you know, that's going the housing sector was never all that strong. A lot of it was high-end and apartments. But now, of course, the new data show that housing is going to take a hit here as a result of rising rates. The auto industry, another important generalized industry, clearly has plateaued. And there are signs that, you know, after all these discounts for the holiday season, we're going to see a decline in auto sales. Retail sales, the latest information I saw was rather poor November sales, and therefore the current Christmas season is not going to be as great as they thought it would be. Industrial production is not doing that well either. All these key sectors are going to be negatively impacted in the U.S., housing, autos, retail sales, wages, business, outside infrastructure, by the rising rates, rising interest rates. They're going to rise, you know, three more times, possibly, during 2017. We'll see. We may have something similar in 17, though, that happened in 16, and that is great instability in certain parts of the global economy that will sort of force the Fed to back off of the rate hikes. That's what happened, you know, with Brexit and some of these other effects last year, this year, 16. You could see the same thing coming next year, because a lot of instability, political instability in Europe, and big question marks. We'll talk about that shortly. Okay. So rising rates mean key sectors of the real economy are going to get whacked, see, while productivity may not really increase, and investment outside infrastructure may not really increase, and wages will remain kind of stagnant for most. And then there's the bond bubble that's bursting here, and rates are rising. not just for U.S. Treasury bonds, but the knock-on effect on other bonds. Junk bond rates are rising, and those companies that have been borrowing heavily in the junk bond market may be experiencing defaults increasing. Municipal bond rates are rising. That means state and local government spending may take a whack as a result. And, of course, with mortgage rates and auto loan rate, defaults will rise. And that could further dampen those two sectors. So the unwinding of the bond bubble here has consequences economically for the U.S. economy as well. Okay, so those are all areas, investment and productivity and wage stagnation, those key sectors, economic sectors of the economy, so forth. As the dollar rises as well, I did mention you're going to have rising cost of imports. So real wages may take a whack because of import cost and inflation rising in the U.S. It's been pretty much non-existent, below 1%. But now it's going to rise somewhat here in 2017. That'll take a bigger impact on real wages and real consumption and spending, and therefore GDP as well. So all these factors in the real economy, you know, you got to look behind all this phony stimulus going on in the stock market. That's for investors who are going to get tax cuts and free money and all, you know, coming back and so forth. That's those folks. They're not us. And these policies are constructed for them, not us, not the rest of us. It's for investors and corporations. People have to realize that. Some key questions about the U.S. economy have to be kept in mind, and that is, looking at monetary policy and the rate hikes by the Fed and tax cuts and infrastructure spending on the government side. You know, that's the new mix. You know, before it was tax cuts but no government infrastructure spending and free money on the central bank side. Now we've shifted, we're shifting, and it's going to be rising interest rates and not as much direct free money from the Fed. It'll be indirect from emerging market flowbacks and tax cuts, but some kind of infrastructure spending. Right. Key questions. Will the rate increase on the central bank side mean less real investment in the U.S. economy as rates rise and the cost of borrowing rises? In other words, it's going to impact all kinds of industries, particularly housing and autos. Will that rate increase, interest rate increase by the Fed's negative effects be greater than the positive investment and job creation effects from infrastructure spending policies? In other words, rising rates are associated here now with, as a consequence to some extent, of the Trump effect, you know, infrastructure spending and tax cuts, right? But the key question is, will it, rising rates have more of a negative impact on the rest of the economy than infrastructure spending will have on certain sectors of the economy? If so, then we're going to have a net negative effect, you see. Will the negative effect of rising rates occur earlier than the positive effects from infrastructure spending? That's like a corollary of this, right? I think so. You know, the rising rates are going to have an immediate effect on much of the economy outside infrastructure, and the infrastructure stimulus is going to be a delayed effect. So the net effect initially is going to be even greater, right? And then there's another element of this, and that is, will the infrastructure spending itself be more capital intensive and thus replace jobs, labor, with capital? Or will it be, quote, shovel-ready, more labor-intensive? I think it's going to be more capital-intensive. You know, we have a big problem and a big trend, not only with free trade destroying jobs in this country, good jobs in manufacturing and high-paid business services, but we have what's called sometimes automation or robots or intensive capital investment in new machinery and equipment and so forth, that's destroying jobs as much as free trade has been, destroying high-paying jobs, right? And Trump doesn't say anything about that. You know, he's wailed against free trade, and I don't think he's against free trade. He's against multilateral free trade, not bilateral free trade. He wants to renegotiate himself, you know, the big businessman making a deal, wheel and deal. But he's for free trade. Don't get me wrong. Notwithstanding all this public consumption stuff about Carrier and Ford and so forth, you know, stop moving your jobs abroad kind of a thing, that's good PR for him, for his base. You know, but how many companies are there? What's he going to do, intervene in every company that's planning and has been moving jobs to Mexico and elsewhere? Is he going to do that? No, he's not going to do that. And he's not going to really change dramatically and radically and quickly any kind of free trade agreements that already exist. He's not going to do that. You know, he's going to continue this, as I've said before. Read my piece, Taming Trump, here on my blog, jackrasmus.com, for that analysis of Trump as not really opposed to free trade. Just the form it takes. That's all. But the point here we get back to, you know, capital intensive. Will infrastructure spending be more capital intensive and actually destroy more jobs than it and replaces labor with capital than it will create jobs? Big question. You know, and that's related to the negative effects of raising rates on the non-infrastructure side of the economy, whack jobs more than infrastructure will create jobs. And then will the infrastructure actually really create jobs if it's capital intensive? And then the rate at which, quickly or with a great delay. And then we can also ask a fourth question here. Will infrastructure investment be mostly from tax cuts rather than government spending projects? These are all key questions relevant to all this talk about infrastructure spending, fiscal spending, that have to be answered that aren't even being discussed. It's just assumed that, infrastructure spending is going to mean jobs, finally, right? And it's going to mean construction jobs, and it's going to mean high-paying jobs. I don't believe it will. I think it's going to be mostly tax-related, private sector-related. I think it will be very capital-intensive. I think there will be a delay and its effect hitting the economy. And in the meantime, I think the negative effects of rising rates will be larger. Okay. So that's sort of a review of how rising rates and infrastructure, this new mix fiscal policy, may impact the U.S. economy. And it's not a very positive picture on the real economy. In the meantime, the financial side of the economy is booming as stock markets hit new records all across the board. We talked about last week. Investors, both institutional, corporate, and individual, get in further subsidized and further rich. You see, they're just shifting to a whole new set of policies to ensure the bottom line objective of continually enriching investors and corporations, that whole thing continues, you see, which is what neoliberalism is fundamentally. Okay, what will be the effects of rising rates on Europe? Okay, well, already we're seeing U.S. rates are rising faster than European rates, and we have a spread, as they say, between European government rates and U.S. rates, 10-year bonds, for example, government bonds, of almost 3%. It'll be 3% in a couple weeks. Now, that huge differential of 3% means money flows out of investors take the money out of Euro government bonds, and they put them in U.S. Treasury bonds. Why keep my money in 1% German bonds when I can make 4% on U.S. bonds here? Already, 3.2 on the 30-year Treasury? 1% maybe on German bonds? Why keep my money there? If I want a safe, stable investment, I can make 2% more. I'm going to take it out of German, and I'm going to put it in U.S. bonds. And that's already happening and will continue to happen as U.S. rates rise faster than European rates. So an investment capital outflow from Europe to the U.S., and that runs right into the desperate attempt for years now of the European Central Bank to try to get more money invested in the real economy by super QE here, quantitative easing, and all this money injections going on for now for several years. By the way, the ECB has decided to continue through 2017, its QE program of pumping money at, $8 billion a year or something like that, a month rather, into the economy. Well, I think they're going to slow it down a little bit, but they're going to extend it. You see, QE was supposed to expire late next summer, but now it's going to go throughout the year. And they'll reduce it from $80 billion a month to $60 billion a month, but the net effect is they're going to pump more because it's going to go longer. Why is the ECB doing this? Because the ECB is very nervous, the European Central Bank, about the instability coming, the political instability in Europe, which is already significant, but is showing signs of fragmenting even greater. Right. We saw recently the Italian vote, where the people, Italians, rejected the neoliberal attempt to centralize more power, in the government, so they could control investment even more, and that was rejected by the Italian people—a 60% vote. We talked about that. Well, that's just the beginning. You see, Brexit was actually the beginning in the UK this past summer, but now we had the Italian vote, and now it's coming in even greater waves. After the first of the year here, we're going to have new elections in the Netherlands in March, in April, May, in France. The Italian government has fallen, and there will be new elections there. And now it looks like Greece is going to be another issue. We'll talk about that if we have time. But, my book, Looting Greece, predicted that the Greek debt crisis was not over. It was just on a hiatus here and was going to erupt again. Well, it looks like it's erupting again. But we'll talk about that if we have time at the end of the show a little bit more. One of the other consequences of U.S. Fed rate hikes on Europe is depreciation of the euro currency. The euro itself, the exchange rate, in other words, to the dollar, is collapsing. It's like $1.05 euro to the dollar, almost at parity. By the way, I predicted 3 years ago in 2013, you can read that on my blog, jackrasmus.com, my predictions 2011-13, go back some way, predicted that the euro would decline to parity to the dollar. That was going to be one for one. And it's almost there. That prediction, by the way, was made when the euro was $1.40 to the dollar. I predicted it would fall to parity, and it's the next couple of weeks it'll fall to parity, maybe a couple months, but it'll be at parity. Well, when you have your currency collapse that much, it should stimulate exports and sales, right? Because your goods are cheaper than everybody else's in the global economy, right? And that should eliminate the need for more QE, which drives down the currency exchange rate as well. Oh, but Europe, the ECB is going to continue with QE because it's unknown political instability. They may have to do some bailouts here. We'll see real quick. The ECB wants to wait and see what happens, even though the euro's already declining. And it's declining because the dollar is rising. And the dollar is rising because interest rates are rising. You see, that's the relationship you go here. If the U.S. dollar appreciates in value, all the other currencies in relation to it decline in value. So the U.S. is devaluating the euro currency and the Chinese yuan and emerging market currencies as well, simply by raising the value of the dollar. And the dollar is being driven by higher interest rates, which is being driven by this policy mix shift. European stock markets, of course, are rising a little bit, but not that much, you see, because of the instability anticipation effect is kind of keeping a lid on the stock markets that aren't rising as rapidly there as they are in the U.S. or in Japan. But it is providing some relief from this negative interest rate phenomenon, which had which was choking investment in Europe. There's been no longer negative. As U.S. rates have risen, bond rates have risen, European bond rates have risen. Not as much. We still have this big spread, but has risen a little bit. So Europe is going to sort of move sideways economically as a result of this shift in policy mix in the U.S. There's some negative effects on Europe. Money outflows because of the spread between the bond rates, but some positive effects as well should stimulate exports a little. But the problem with stimulating exports by depreciating your currency today in this global market is that global trade is slowing down everywhere. See, so an export-driven strategy, which is Europe, is really doomed. All they can do is steal exports from each other, And That's been going on some time within the Eurozone, and that's why the periphery in Europe is such trouble. You know, Germany has been sucking the economic lifeblood out of the periphery. Okay, so Europe, some positives, some negative effects from this Fed rate hike, but nothing to really stimulate the economy. What about China? Well, some significant effects here. The Chinese currency, the yuan, trades within a band to the U.S. Between 6.2 and 6.9 yuan per dollar, and it's already pushing up and pushing actually beyond the 6.9 floor of the band in which it trades. All right. In other words, we've had a devaluation within the accepted parameters that China has set, but it can't sustain that. It's going to have to devalue further. And the U.S., by raising interest rates, raises the dollar, and that, again, just as in Europe, depreciates the yuan. And that's already having negative effects on the stock market in China and more capital flight. In other words, if you have your money invested in yuan in China and it's declining in value, you want to get out of it. Why hold a currency that's collapsing in value and providing paper losses, right? You want to get out of it and get into a currency that that is rising, in other words, the dollar. But to do that, you've got to sell your assets. That's why the stock market's going down. And you've got to move the money out of the country. That's why you've got capital flight out of the country. Now, stemming capital flight, the government over there, Chinese government, has been cracking down on capital flight and spending money in order to stabilize the currency of the yuan, to keep it from depreciating, right? China's already spent $800 billion to protect the currency. $800 billion. And Trump says, oh, they're manipulators. They're too. I mean, would he spend $800 billion to protect the dollar? No. Right? But the Chinese are. You know, so where's this currency manipulation going on? That doesn't mean they won't manipulate in the near future if the U.S. provokes a trade war with them. Yeah, they'll respond. But so far, they've been protecting the currency, preventing it from collapsing even further, and spending hundreds of billions of dollars to do it, to prevent capital flight, and also capital controls to prevent capital flight out of the country. But the capital flight controls, you know, you still had $500 billion has flowed out of China, despite the capital controls, as the currency has devalued. The People's Bank of China, the central bank, I predict will pump even more liquidity into the economy, because if money is flowing out in hundreds of billions, it's going to slow the Chinese real economy, so the central bank pumps more money into the economy. The problem in China is a lot of this liquidity injection is going into financial assets and bubbles. We got rotating bubbles, as I've said before, asset price bubbles, stock market, asset management products, you know, local government financing vehicles. Those are the rotating bubbles going on. Every time the central bank pumps more money, a lot of it gets sucked into bubbles and financial assets instead of the real economy. But when you got so much capital flight flowing out, they got to pump money in. And so they're feeding the bubbles and trying to, at the same time, control the bubbles. Right? A wild card here is, will the U.S. set off a trade war with China? We don't know yet. The other wild card is if China does devalue, it will have a contagion effect on the rest of the Southeast Asian economies. What we may see is a big official devaluation, or just allowing it to float, the currency, the yuan, to float, and that's sort of a big gun that China's going to hold against the U.S. if the U.S. Politically or economically wants to intensify the conflict, right? We'll see whether Trump does that. Emerging markets, the effect is even greater than on China, right? Emerging markets, Southeast Asia, Latin America in particular, are full of dollar-denominated corporate debt. I'm talking about tens of trillions of dollars of corporate debt. and it's debt in dollars. So when the dollar rises, the cost of servicing, paying the principal and interest on that debt, rises as well. And if they got to pay more for the service, their existing debt, there's less for business investment. Slows down the economies. Latin America, Southeast Asia, already, and in many places, in recessions, it's going to get worse. Right? As the dollar rises, their currencies depreciate. Just look at Mexico. The rapid depreciation going on in the Mexican peso. And that means it has a big effect on their stock and bond markets, which are collapsing. And capital flight follows depreciation. And what these countries do to try to stop the outflow of capital because of the depreciation of the currency, because of U.S. policies, is to raise their own domestic interest rates. But that slows down their domestic economies, makes their recessions even deeper, their real economy recessions. So as rates rise, domestic rates rise, right? Real investment slows. Good example is Brazil, Argentina, and as I said, Mexico. All the currencies are collapsing. They got capital flight. Their stock markets are collapsing. The money is flowing out back to the U.S., right? Feeding stock and bond markets in the U.S., enabling the Fed to say, well, we don't have to continue low interest rates because all the money's flowing back. Right? We can raise interest rates. And then all this decline in currency also has a secondary negative effect on import prices, which rise in these countries. The cost of imports rise because their currency in relation to the dollar collapses. Now, what that means for average working people is less jobs because interest rates slow down their economy and investment, so they have less jobs, but they also have rising inflation from imports at the same time. So they got stagflation, right? The worst of two worlds, declining real wages and consumption because of inflation on imports and lower jobs because of raising interest. You want to see exactly what happens? Look at Brazil. Now, the Brazilian economy has collapsed because the central bank has raised interest rates and has for several years, and they're going to raise them more. It's not all this policies of the workers' government down there. That was just a cover. It's the central bank sabotaged the Workers' Party. Well, anyway, the Federal Reserve, you know, let me conclude at this point. The Federal Reserve is the global central bank. It's not as if we have multi-poles of central banks anymore. The Federal Reserve is the global central bank, you know, and up to now, it has been looking at the consequences if it raised interest rates and thus pushed the dollar up and caused all these effects, you know, depreciation and capital flight and all the stuff we've been talking about, emerging markets, China. It's been looking at that and said, gee, if we do that, we're going to cause real problems in emerging markets, and our multinational U.S. companies are going to experience significant profit collapse. And that's been happening now as rates have been rising. That's one of the reasons why the Fed, being a global central bank, has held off raising interest rates because of the consequence for profitability of multinational companies in emerging markets. Right? But now, what the U.S. is saying, well, we're going to focus more on infrastructure spending here. Okay, so now we're seeing the shift, right? The Fed is shifting from protecting multinational corporations and emerging markets to cooperating on the fiscal side with Trump to stimulate the markets and business in the U.S. But we saw that stimulation from infrastructure spending may not be all that great. Well, we'll keep watching this very closely. But that's the picture of Fed rate increases and its impact on the U.S. and the global economy. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.